you're one of the roughly 10,000 users of Published Press, you'll recognize my guest this week, if for no other reason than because it's his name that shows up in your inbox periodically talking about what new stuff his company is putting out. Published Press is a suite of WordPress plugins for publishers, content teams, and newsrooms, but I didn't anticipate that the journey that got Steve to where he is started as an English teacher in the part of rural Georgia where Deliverance was filmed on a $27,000 a year salary with a wife, a mortgage, and a quiet side hustle in web design that started outpacing his day job within a few months. Unlike some of my previous guests, Steve is not the person who grew up taking apart computers at age 10. He came to all of this sideways, and that accidental path gave him a unique perspective on open source, on customers, on how software actually gets built in the real world. We talked about Drupal 7 and the backwards compatibility break that became an off-ramp for an entire generation of CMS users, about what it means to build for publishers, not just the enterprise ones, but also the five-person local newsrooms trying to fill the hole left by a shuttered legacy paper. And we talked about Steve's method for building software, no roadmap, no grand vision, just reading every single support ticket that comes in. Without further ado, Steve Burge. Welcome to Community and Code, the podcast where we talk to the human beings behind the commits. And today I am here with founder of Published Press, Steve Burge. Published Press is a WordPress publishing suite of tools for publishing stuff on WordPress sites. And WordPress likes to say that it democratizes publishing, and there's a lot of publishers that use it. So I think that that's kind of a pretty cool thing to do. Welcome to the show, Steve. Tell us about yourself.
Oh, thanks, Chris. I live in Florida. As you can tell from my accent, I was born and bred on the southeast corner of Florida. I came from England originally, and now just in a few months ago, I've ended up living in the United States longer than I lived in England. So I'm more American, I guess, than anything else. And actually became an American about a couple of months ago. Took the citizenship test. I know who the first president was, who the second president was, how many people sit in the House of Representatives. I had to study for all that stuff.
Wow, I don't know that many Americans have had to study for most of those things in many, many years. I recently had a similar tipping point where I believe I live in Salt Lake City, Utah, but I'm originally from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I believe last year or the year before or something, I crossed the border over to, I've lived in Utah longer than I've lived in California.
You make you a Utah. I don't know how to say that.
Utah.
I've been in maybe lived a somewhat similar life to you. I think we got started in the open source world, did a lot of Drupal, and just because of the way the market has been over the last 10 years or so, I've ended up more in the WordPress space. But the through line connecting it all has been open source.
Awesome. Yeah. So, yeah, let's just dive into that. Like, what first got you involved in being interested in open source in general?
Oh, well, I'm not one of those people who, you hear those stories of someone who at like 10 years old had like an Atari mm-hmm. on their living room floor mm-hmm. and was taking the computer apart, rebuilding it, writing their first program at the age of 8. None of that.
I've had some of those guests.
Yes. I mean, you've ended up in the right profession. It's naturally for you, my path was more accidental. I was a teacher for a good number of years, middle school, high school, until I arrived in the United States and got a wife and kids. And also realized how much they pay teachers in the United States. At that point, I needed to do something else because having a wife and kids and a mortgage was more than I could afford on my teacher's salary.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think that says more about how the United States values or undervalues teaching than it says about your particular path, because I don't think that your particular path is unique necessarily in seeing that stark, like having that stark realization and being like, yeah, no, I actually got bills to pay.
Yeah, we ended up in a fairly good industry for that. You work in software, you work in hosting in the United States, you're going to have a fairly good living. But I was in Georgia, in the north part of Georgia, in the United States, north of Atlanta, up in the Appalachian Hills. If you've ever seen the movie Deliverance, basically we were where the movie Deliverance was shot. And I believe back then, this was like 2004, 2005, the starting pay for a teacher was something like $27,000, $28,000 a year.
Wow. Yeah.
And I came in with several years of teaching experience, and I took 1 year of teaching in the States and basically started a web design business in the evening. And it took probably 3 or 4 months before the evening job of running a small web design agency was making more money than my day job as a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely believe it, especially if you're able to get a regular stream of clients. So in those early days of like doing your freelancing work of starting a web design company, I imagine you were looking at open source CMSs and tools like that to provide value to make your work easier as a developer. What sorts of things were you gravitating toward, and what sorts of sites were you building?
We started with some Joomla sites and some Drupal sites for people. And I was fairly good as a designer, but didn't quite have the strong background of some of the people we were working alongside. So I ended up basically taking my teaching background and applying it to open source and trying to teach people how to use it. Mm. We did videos, we did books, we did in-person classes. And it's hard to think back now to before even things like lynda.com, before things like that. But there was a huge market for getting on an airplane and flying to some part of the country, standing in front of a classroom and teaching people how to use Drupal, how to use open source.
Yeah, they're back in long before my time at Pantheon. That was a thing that DevRel and other teams were doing, was like shipping folks off to have on sites with clients. One of my early gigs as a WordPress developer, I was approached by somebody from Pluralsight, which is an online developer training platform. Very early days of Pluralsight, where they were kind of like just trying to build out their video library and like branch out beyond like Microsoft specific stack technologies, and so they saw me speak at a WordCamp. But their history too, like they started out as a company doing on-site training for like .NET and like other sort of like ASP and like Microsoft specific things. And then they're like, hey, we could like record these things and then distribute them and then not have to fly people places. And that's how like the web platform got built. So yeah, they're definitely like right about that time I'd been around long enough to have seen that path.
Yeah, the demand was there, particularly, this is not a knock on Drupal, but this is maybe a knock on how Drupal was seen in the marketplace, was that we could sell Drupal training all day long.
Yeah.
But we can never sell WordPress. People were like, oh, WordPress is too easy. Our staff will get it. We don't need to really teach our staff WordPress. It's all self-explanatory. But Drupal, oh, come up here 5 days, teach our team, it's really complicated. We could sell Drupal training week after week of it for years. because it had that reputation in the marketplace that it was intimidating and needed to be explained clearly to people.
Yeah, well, and there's something to be said too of that perception that Drupal had and also still has in many cases of like it's a toolkit, it's complex, it can handle, and as such, it can handle more complexity in your site build. So like the budgets that you expect for a Drupal site versus a WordPress site for a long time, maybe that's a little bit different now as like WordPress has kind of become more dominant. But for a long time, like you would expect a significantly higher dollar value associated with a Drupal build for a site than a WordPress build. I mean, I remember, you know, early days of freelancing, like, hey, can you build this WordPress site for $500? Well, no, I'm not going to build you a site for $500.
And also they, maybe Acquia and specifically and some of the agencies around them did a good job of selling into the enterprise.
Yeah.
I have a clear memory of going to one DrupalCon, I want to say maybe 2013 or so, that I'd always gone to DrupalCons and it had been people look like me or you. Like you've got a flannel shirt on, I've got a t-shirt on, people that look like traditional developers. And I suddenly remember walking into a DrupalCon and there were salespeople, like slick suits. One of the guys said he'd just moved from Adobe, didn't know anything about Drupal, but he was here to sell Drupal for Acquia. There was a sudden transformation where some of the Drupal companies were staffing up with real salespeople ready to sell real enterprise projects. And so they were able to get those, the big government customers, the big enterprise, and projects like WordPress were behind at that time. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the infrastructure. They didn't have the big companies to complete the big RFPs.
So what facilitated your transition away from Joomla and Drupal into WordPress? Was it ease of use or was it something else?
Drupal 7.
Drupal 7, yes.
There we go. That's it. For people that may not know, it was an enormous basically a 100% backwards compatibility break. And really compelled a lot of the companies we were working with to take a look outside of Drupal. A lot of them were saying, well, if we're going to rebuild our entire platform, this gives us an off-ramp to look at something else outside of Drupal. And a lot of them exited. I think I talked with Josh, one of the founders of Pantheon.
Yep.
And I think he'd done some research at some point that more Drupal 6 sites ended up on WordPress than on Drupal 7. Mm. It was just an enormous exit point because of the costs of moving to Drupal 7.
Mm-hmm. And then they kind of did the same thing between Drupal 7 and 8 when like Drupal 8 was another major refactor, another major shift in how Drupal was built, and it would required another sort of rebuild. And again, like when you're facing that choice of do I rebuild my site again or do I move to something where I never have to worry about it, a lot of people jumped ship and went to WordPress. Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, Drupal 8 was perhaps an even bigger backwards compatibility break.
That's where they introduced Composer as a fundamental part of Drupal Core. Yep.
Yeah, and those two back to back. And so, yeah, that was a big change for us. And it basically also caused a huge business pivot for us because a lot of our Drupal customers were like government departments who had no problem flying us up to Washington, D.C. for training. But that didn't exist in the WordPress space, really. So we pivoted hard to doing books and videos instead.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, do you, like, from, and we'll get into, like, what you're working on now, but, like, I'm interested in this idea that we've hit on a couple times that the theory that, you know, WordPress isn't or wasn't ready for enterprise, or this perception that that it wasn't, and like this sort of kind of aligns with like when I started doing like getting into agency WordPress development, and like that was back in like I don't know, 2014-ish, I guess, for me. My first agency gig was at Web Dev Studios, and they do a lot of enterprise stuff. And like there is definitely, it felt like, you know, the default assumption for an enterprise company was not, I want to use WordPress. We had to like sell them on, you're paying a lot of money for like Adobe Experience Manager. You can do those things in WordPress for cheaper, you know, or like you can, or you want to pay us, great, we'll build, you know, bespoke things for you. Like, but there had to be like, there is like, you had to go into that conversation with like a defense prepared, you know, like a pitch to sell the software before you could even have the conversation about what the agency is going to do.
The sales process was always more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something is that something that you also saw at the time?
Yeah, we ran into quite a few sort of government agencies and large companies that were having trouble with Drupal. They were having trouble with their rollouts. And quite often I'd sit down with them and say, hey, what was the decision process? Why did you choose Drupal as opposed to Adobe or WordPress? And often it would just come down to a lack of knowledge often. They'd say things like, oh, well, WordPress doesn't have the ability to do role management, for example. Oh, so you can get this plugin over here. And that's really an easy problem. I guess it led me to realize just how many of these RFPs are just one on almost a random basis. That it just, whoever is signing off on the RFP or making a decision often is really just not that well informed on the decision, and might just make a decision on which platform to use based on a hunch.
Yeah, for sure. And I read a book recently, Recoding America, that specifically talked about digital services in the US, like the formation of the digital services department, which I don't think exists anymore, or has been absorbed into Doge, but used to exist for a while. But like also like the like what existed before and the way the RFPs were written before within government, specifically like federal government, and like the legacy systems and like the level of like the requirements, and they had to get approval from all of these different people, but like the different departments or the different people signing off on things didn't necessarily like have the conversations with everybody involved, so like there'd be requirements in there that didn't make sense or like required a whole bunch of extra stuff. Like there was a story in there that was talking about GPS, and like they were going to roll out a big massive update to the GPS software that gets put on satellites, right? But because of some old loophole or some old requirement in some previous doc, the only communication method that was allowed for the RFP was like XML RPC for communicating with the satellites, which is, I mean, you're laughing, you know, like it's old, it's slow, and like the new stuff was better and faster and would facilitate, you know, more accurate GPS coordinates. And it like, because of delays, because of that particular requirement, the new stuff never rolled out, and we never got the GPS update and like that went out when the project was actually signed off on, and it was still like XML RPC, or not XML RPC, but it was SOAP. It was SOAP API, I believe.
So they needed a root and branch reform, essentially, of the way things were done, from the technology stack to the way the software was purchased to the way it was, the RFPs were written. A deep, deep transformation was needed.
Exactly. And there's like all sorts of stories about like, you know, so many systems within the US government are built on these old legacy COBOL systems, which run really, really well and efficiently because COBOL was super efficient, and it had to be because it was back in the day when you didn't have as much memory and whatever. But now there's like all this impetus to like do a refresh or an update, but nobody knows how to actually fundamentally edit the COBOL systems. And also the COBOL systems aren't broken. So they just layer upon layer of new UI on top of these old systems. So like whenever you encounter anything in like a government system that feels inefficient or does a weird thing, it's probably because there's like three layers deep of like UI that has been placed on top of this ancient COBOL system that wasn't designed to do the thing that you want to do like natively. And nobody knows how to actually make the COBOL system do that thing.
I got to say, we with our government work, and we did probably at one point it was like 90% plus government work. We noticed a real change when Pantheon came along and had started to get its fingers into some of the government business. But the development tools that were provided made the government agencies quite a lot more comfortable. Mm. We did a lot. Oh, sorry, the whole thing went blank there. I'll start again. We did a lot of work with the government of Arizona. They moved lock, stock, and barrel hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sites over to the Pantheon platform. And you guys had a slick development workflow and a standard workflow that made them comfortable to basically commit the entire future of the Arizona government online to being on Drupal and being on Pantheon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that like, I mean, that's obviously like, that's the sales pitch that Pantheon is going to give, right? It's like that we build the tools that make your development teams happier and work faster and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I remember again, even before I was working here using Pantheon as a developer, and Just the fact that, like, again, when I first started in agency work was a long time ago. And at the time, Pantheon, I believe, was pretty much the only one that already had, like, a native Git integration. Yep. So just that, you know, as opposed to other providers that we were using, like, that was made it super easy. And then, like, you know, having multi-devs, the ability to, like, have a whole environment spun off of a branch was like revolutionary, like made my life so much. And so I was like, why can't we just put all of our projects on this? Well, we already have a contract with so-and-so, so we can't do that. But I agree, you know, like, and you know, shouldn't be terribly surprising that I am currently a Pantheon employee because of that experience, because that as a developer, But moving on to like, you know, obviously you did some agency stuff and you're doing some government stuff. But you are the founder of this thing called Publish Press. What is the sort of origin story of that?
Oh, well, that came out of a pivot from our training work, which was getting quieter. You've seen most of the big training companies now have kind of gone away. Hmm. Like Lynda got sold and it's kind of like a little tile in the corner of LinkedIn now.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say LinkedIn just swallowed everything.
It did. There was Udemy, which mm-hmm. long past its heyday now. It feels like it's going to become one of those bending spoon acquisitions and kind of left for dead. And the whole training market got a lot quieter. So we were looking for what was next, and we were doing some software development at the time, started to look at WordPress as an opportunity, and really started to see a lot of gaps in the publishing space in WordPress. But that took a lot of trial and error. We were very familiar with the Joomla world and the Drupal world mm-hmm. and even the Magento world as well. But less familiar with WordPress. And I've got to tell you, none of the lessons we learned in those other platforms were worth a damn. And moving to WordPress. I was chatting with someone the other day who's moving from WordPress or WooCommerce particularly to Shopify. Mm-hmm. And they're like, it's like starting from zero or less than zero. Like, yeah, if you move to a new ecosystem like that, it might also might even be helpful not to have any of your previous knowledge because it ain't going to apply in the new world.
Yeah, do you think that that is fundamentally like a symptom of replatforming, or do you think that there's something that is distinct about WordPress that that makes that reset more felt?
The exception might be if you're getting in very early. For example, if you were moving to WordPress in 2008, maybe, when something like Gravity Forms was just launching, or if you were moving to Shopify 10 years ago to become a Shopify app developer, but those markets are mature now, so you've got to play within their rules. You have to learn the network of people, how they move, how they interact with each other. And just particularly with WordPress, incredibly major differences, like you're coming from a Drupal ecosystem where no one sells any software. In fact, it's objectively looked down upon to sell code to WordPress, where that's the entire business.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that is changing in the Drupal space. I mean, they're trying to, Dries wants to start a marketplace, an official Drupal marketplace. One of my recent guests was is Mike Herschel in the Drupal community, who is a theme developer who created basically a theme shop for Drupal themes. For premium Drupal themes. So like that is shifting, but it's interesting having those conversations with people like Mike, because they're having to figure out how to do from scratch in Drupal. It's the same thing that you just said. It's like it's that same sort of like replatforming thing, and you have to learn everything from scratch because they're having to learn from scratch how do we do business with code for Drupal when there wasn't like there it's Wild West, right? So they're trying to like he had to read up on licenses, like, and we've been dealing with licenses, like, I mean, we've been having the licensing conversation since Chris Pearson and Thesis like 15 years ago or something. Like we've this is well-tread territory for us in the WordPress ecosystem, and they're having to figure that out from scratch, and they're having to figure out like, you know, like, yeah, he had to make the decision of like, you know, do I do like how do I license things? How do I sell things? How do I distribute things? And all of that stuff basically has been a solved problem in WordPress for a long time now. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting, because I remember seeing last week maybe that Dries had wrote a blog post basically saying mea culpa on backwards compatibility, which was fair play to him. He said, I was wrong. Backwards compatibility is more important than I thought it was. And it sounds like they've done the same thing with allowing people to sell access to modules too.
Not modules. What I have heard from the conversations that I've had with people in the Drupal community is that probably modules won't have that same sort of like marketplace ecosystem.
Okay.
But themes, yes. And what the official Drupal marketplace is going to be focused around is the idea of site templates, which is basically like, almost like if you think about like a Linux distribution, right? Like here's the whole thing, and then within that you can customize stuff. Like here is a distribution of Drupal for a real estate site that has everything that you need for that real estate site, including a theme and like some like recipes for like these modules are going to be installing for this type of content or whatever. So it's basically like the what I think the Drupal Association is trying to get at is lowering the barrier to entry, because they realize there's this history of Drupal sites are expensive. And that's actually like for a lot of agencies and a lot of people that were doing business in that space, that was a good thing. We want our stuff to be expensive because we are skilled engineers and we want to get paid. But for users, and especially with the decline of the Drupal bar graph of usage of installs, they want to lower the barrier to entry to make it easier to get an entry point into Drupal. And the theory is that by creating these, making it easy for me to get started by saying I want this type of a site, then I, you know, having a marketplace to buy a thing, a package that's like, okay, here's how you'll get started in like 5 minutes, and then you can just customize the content. The idea is that that'll make it maybe help with that bar graph and make number go up. Steve is now considering building Publish Press for Drupal now.
Well, if they're not allowed to sell modules.
That's fair. Yeah, yeah.
my initial feeling of that, what you've described there, is it's a little bit of skepticism.
I mean, it's an like I'm keeping an open mind, right? Like, yeah. I think that like I see the good intention, I see the value. I don't know how it's going to play out. Like, honestly, like I've used the new Drupal CMS. I've used their new editor thing. I've seen demos of things. I've used AI. They've got like a whole AI project that's been funded by the Drupal Association, and seen that and how that works inside, like, natively. Like, you can basically have a chatbot that you talk to and it will do stuff for you. Like, I want a content type that for an event and it will build that thing for you. And that's pretty cool. So, like, there's a lot of really cool stuff happening. The question that I always ask is this enough? Is this the thing? How are you going to get over that hump? And I guess that, you know, that remains to be seen. But, like, competition is never a bad thing. And, like, I don't know. Maybe WordPress needs to be knocked down a peg. Like, you know, like, maybe we've gotten a little complacent. So how you built Publish Press and what, like, led to the decision that like publishing specifically was an area that you felt was maybe underrepresented or something that had growth potential.
A lot of the sort of first principles we took into our WordPress work came from Drupal customers. They were saying, these are the things that are important to us at the enterprise level. We need good role management. We need good permission systems. And that was a reason for them to choose Drupal. And we looked at WordPress and said, hey, if these big customers value this, they're going to value this in WordPress too.
Yep.
So we took a lot of those lessons on what enterprise companies want and tried to build those systems in. And it has worked. We get a lot of enterprise customers, a lot of universities, a lot of sort of high profile names to put on our banner. But a lot of small publishers have found us as well, newspapers, startups, and no offense to universities and no offense to enterprise customers, but it's perhaps those smaller customers maybe pay a little bit less, that are maybe, say, maybe 20-25% of our business that have really been the most interesting to me. You see, like, a little 5-person shop in Atlanta or Tampa starting a newspaper for their area and really trying to dig in and replace all the legacy newspapers that have collapsed in their town. And it's inspiring. It reminds me a little bit of some of the startup companies in the WordPress space. They're like, hey, we know we're not going to make $10 million, but we're going to make a living and we're going to try and do something good and helpful to people. I think there's a real kind of similar sense of purpose, and got to know some of these publishers over the years working with them and seen their success. And they're all on WordPress. You're in Utah. Mm-hmm. If there's any, trying to think if we come across any like new newspapers or magazines starting up in Utah or in Tampa near us or wherever it might be, they're on WordPress. WordPress has a 98% market share with these companies. And a lot of the old newspapers have their own legacy CMSs, but WordPress is really dominating in this space. And it's a good thing. It's cheap. These journalists are paying themselves $30,000, $40,000 a year, just enough to pay rent and eat some ramen. So WordPress is a good fit for them.
And do you think that it's really that sort of low cost and lower barrier to entry that has made WordPress distinct within sort of the publishing space?
It is easy. The UI is good. I rarely hear any of these customers complain about the UI. They can log in. They're in the block editor. They can start writing. They get it. They're people who are used to writing on platforms that are similar. Maybe a lot of these people may have worked at, say, USA Today, or maybe a bigger, more brand name newspaper. They're used to working in a content management system. They move to WordPress. They're good to go. It makes sense to them.
Yeah. Did you see, like, one of a lesson that I learned sort of in real time as I was presenting at WordCamp Long Beach a number of years ago? I was at the time I was working at HumanMade. HumanMade was a very early adopter of building Gutenberg-based like functionality. We were using Gutenberg and implementing Gutenberg before it was merged into Core. And so we were very Gutenberg yay and Gutenberg and early adopters. And so obviously my talk that got approved, and I was speaking at WordCamp Long Beach, was about like how the block editor is going to make everything easier, is going to revolutionize content editing. And what I realized as I was giving this talk, especially during the Q&A section at the end, was that there were a lot of people who were not just like skeptical of the block editor, but really like fundamentally it was going to increase the amount of work because they had to learn a new thing, because the classic editor was fine, because they were used to it. Even at the time, I believe there is data about like the bell graph for learning curve for Gutenberg was smaller. It was easier to learn Gutenberg than it was to learn do things or similar things in the classic editor. It was really like the people who had been used to the thing that was in WordPress, and now they're being forced to, you know, learn a new thing. Like there's a lot of resistance and a lot of like, I didn't ask for this. Did you also feel that as you're, you know, building this plugin the suite of plugins that are ostensibly for publishers in this sort of space, the same sort of resistance to the block editor?
No, I hear them. If I go on social media, I hear them. In real life, in our work, I don't hear them. To say something controversial, I think those people are like the COBOL users of the WordPress space. Hey, you want to go and keep on using technology that's that old? Great. It runs. Like you say, the government, half the government still runs on it. We still have a Joomla business that has well over 1,000 customers still. And people, even though Joomla's kind of been sidelined from the mainstream of open source, still people there to love it. If people want to stick on the classic editor, they can be our COBOL users and let the rest of us keep moving ahead, but they can stick with the classic editor if they want. The real normal people using WordPress, that at least in my experience, I'm sure perhaps people doing more complicated things with the editor may have bigger complaints about it, but our publishers who are getting their they have maybe two or three big stories to write each week. They get on with the block editor and they like it and use it and not had any complaints.
Since you work with a lot of publishers and specifically like newspapers and things of that nature, I wonder if you have seen effects of like how the decline of print media has affected maybe the adoption of WordPress or the adoption of digital tools, or like just what sorts of things you maybe have picked up from just being in this space.
Oh, for sure. The vast majority of these journalists have had prior careers. They've worked at a big brand name newspaper, or maybe the original. Say you're in Orlando, there was the Orlando Sentinel, Tampa Bay Times. Whichever city you're in, there was a leading newspaper, often two or three. And as those newspapers went away, these journalists went and often started something for themselves, and they would go digital only. They would not even consider a print edition. And they would often they pick one or two social channels. The teams are not big enough perhaps to carry across five or six different platforms, but they will pick YouTube. There's one big new publisher in Mississippi. Mississippi Today, that does a lot of YouTube work. We've worked with some publishers in Texas that use WhatsApp a lot because they have a big Hispanic audience, and WhatsApp use is massive there. So they have a WhatsApp channel. A couple on Instagram. They will use these digital tools to move more quickly than some of the big legacy newspapers. But the heart of it, where their original stories and their original reporting lives, is WordPress.
Do you see, like, I see a lot of particularly, like, you know, individual journalists or individual sort of content creators that maybe have been orphaned by the closure or the downsizing of a larger paper or a publication, moving to platforms like, you know, at one point it was Medium. I think a lot of people are moving to Substack. Do you see and in a lot of ways, this fundamentally gets into the argument of like owning your own content, right? Because like if you're using a tool like that, like Substack, which is very popular, and you can, you know, build in subscriptions and stuff like that where you get paid for your work. The downside of that is obviously your content lives on Substack. Substack could go out of business. They could sell your content. They could do whatever. You don't necessarily own that. Do you see that sort of tension or that sort of like competition with publishing on something that you own, like an open source tool like WordPress?
Yeah, the people that go to Substack tend to be the one person teams. Maybe they start that way and they add a couple of support people. But it does tend to be the personalities, the bloggers who go to Substack. We see quite a few newspapers using Ghost, another open source platform. People who lean more on the newsletter side often go to Beehive. So there's definitely some alternatives out there. But when it comes to actually building a brand where you have 4, 5, 6, 7, and hopefully in a couple of years, 10 or 20 people on staff, then WordPress is the place people go.
Yeah. I see we're getting towards the end, that I want to at least give some opportunity for you to like talk about the thing that you know, Published Press is, that like what it's there for, what people would want to use it for. I mean, I feel like it would be a disservice if I did not give you an opportunity to like at least talk a little bit about the thing that you built.
Oh, well, I guess let me take ownership of this and say I, as the person that got this started, have never really had a big roadmap. Never sat down and said Publish Press is going to be this. Mm. We started with one plugin and just listened to our customers like crazy. And that's probably led to slightly haphazard development. I know some people have the ability to sit down and visualize the awesome product they want to build and then just go ahead and start building it. I don't have that ability. We have 10 plugins now, and I sent a newsletter recently saying we're going to be about 15 plugins by the end of 2026. And it's always been build feature X, talk to the customers. The customers say, that's great. What we need is now feature Y. And we build feature Y. Customers come back to us. Yeah, that's pretty good, but why? I wish Y worked like this, and maybe how about feature Z? It's always been iterative. And the focus has been on making WordPress a really good publishing platform. So a lot of it is just filling in the gaps with what's missing. Like both of us come from Joomla and Drupal backgrounds. Both of those content management systems by default have a expiry date for content. Mm. WordPress is the best publishing platform in the world, but it doesn't have an expiry date.
Yeah.
So one of our plugins got started that way, by just providing an expiry date. WordPress has a revisions feature which allows you to see all of the changes that have been made to a particular post you're writing, but it's kind of tucked away in a very small corner of the screen, mm-hmm. and really hard to navigate and actually browse mm-hmm. through all those changes. Mm-hmm. So we have a plugin that makes it easier. So we try and work with the WordPress core and basically fill in gaps as our customers find them and tell us where they are. So WordPress's aim is to democratize publishing. We kind of try and piggyback on that, and the core can't do everything. We try and fill in all the important gaps that the core is missing to help publishers.
Yeah, I definitely like the most rewarding times for me as a developer have been when I was building a specific thing, could call it a product, but like a particular plugin or whatever, and really being able to take the feedback of the people that were using it and use that feedback to iterate on the thing that I was building. So it may feel haphazard, it may look haphazard, but I really like that feels like a good approach, even if it's not the approach that like a product manager would approve of like having the whole thing, because a lot of times like the grand plan like is like what if one thing on that roadmap is not something like for that roadmap to be appropriate, you need to user research all of those points, right? And by the time you do all the user research and then you build all those features in and then you release the thing, it's entirely possible that your users have moved on to something else. So I believe that the iterative approach is I think that's a really good approach. So don't like downplay that. I think that that's a really valuable part of the process.
Yeah, there are there's a guy Kevin Geary who mm-hmm. is a character on WordPress social media, mm-hmm. and he has that ability, I think, that he basically fundraised like maybe $1 million or so, some enormous amount of money to build his Etch site builder platform. He basically laid it out. This is what we're going to build. Mm-hmm. I do not have that ability at all. It's always been step by step, and some days it feels exhausting because I read every single customer support ticket that comes in, which is exhausting.
Yeah.
But I think by the time, I mean, if we scaled up to Pantheon's size, that's not going to happen. It's going to break at some point. But we're at about a dozen staff members and say 10,000 customers total. So it's still feasible. And you read every customer support ticket, you kind of, through osmosis, you kind of understand what your customers want.
Yeah, you pick up on the patterns. Yep. Yeah.
But you would never read that in a project management book. Project management for dummies. they'd say that's a terrible way to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they probably would. But at the same time, I know product managers that like feel like they don't talk to customers enough and like want to have more of that. So like there's like, yeah, at either end of the spectrum, I think you can't win.
Yeah, I mean, once you get to something, maybe perhaps a Pantheon size, then talking to the customers is much more of a formal exercise often. Like, hey, do you have 20 minutes on your calendar where you can sit down and give me formal feedback? A lot of the feedback you're listening to in customer support is, oh, beep, this isn't working.
Right.
Or like much more visceral.
Well, thank you so much, Steve, for coming on. Before we go, I'd like to give you an opportunity to let people know where they could find you on the internet and what things you're working on and any links that you might want to share for our audio listeners or video viewers or whatever.
I would say these days that I'm mostly on LinkedIn. It's the most high-value platform. You can find me as Steve Burge on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you again, Steve, for coming on the show. Steve is, again, available on LinkedIn and Published Press is publishedpress.com, I believe. Go check it. Go ahead.
There is a funny story there.
Oh?
Oh, that some enormous YouTube social influencers also decided to call their company Published Press.
Oh, cool.
And they're
getting a lot of free traffic?
Well, entirely the wrong free traffic. And I get lots of their emails now. I get like NDAs, contracts, offers to do things. recently they opened the YouTube word is merch, right? Merch, selling merch. They opened a merch store and put publishedpress.com instead of their different TLD on the emails. So I got all their merch store complaints coming through as well.
Well,
we are publishedpress.com. The YouTube guys are Published Press and some other TLD.
Well, you are the real Published Press in my mind, not those other Published Presses. Thank you again for joining. Thank everyone else who's watching or listening to this in the future, and we will see you on the internet.
Thanks, Chris.